Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Carl, and I am definitely an alcoholic. And a gratefully recovering one at that. Thank you, John. Thank you for for inviting me to speak. My understanding of when asked to tell our stories is to share what it was like, what happened, and then what it's like now. And so I think my perspective, I've had a chance, and I apologize if some of you have heard my story before. I don't remember what I said, so it probably will be completely different. But the idea is over, I was just talking to John before, is I know the first few times that I had a chance to tell my story, it was, as usual, about me. Because I was worried about what I would say, about what other people would think. And, you know, that, as like many things, that I learn over time that that's not really what this should be about. It's not about me. Hopefully, I prayed for this morning, is that I say something so that someone hears something that helps them stay sober. And that's really, John asked me if I was nervous, and, you know, part of my profession, I speak to a lot. I'm not very good at it, but they pay me to do it anyway. So, stupid people. I convince them too. So I do that. That doesn't make me nervous. But this does, because, you know, it's, you know, taking a sword and spilling my guts, and so hopefully you get something out of this. My oldest daughter, or my youngest daughter, said that she, hey, you know what, I told her what I was doing today, and she comes rolling in from somewhere with her friends and says, oh, that sounds great, I've never really heard you tell your story, Dad, I'll come listen. And she said, well, what time is it? And I said, 9. And she said, can you just record it? and I'll listen later. And I, oh my God! I live with 5, well, 4, and 2 are at college, but they both came back last night. So I live with a bunch of teenagers, and I used to have hair. So it's a blessing. I keep saying that. So anyway, so what it was like? I grew up in Maine. I had, at the time, highly deficient parents because they didn't give me what I wanted when I wanted it. It's, you know, in hindsight, they were fantastic. There's a lot of years that I spent blaming or coming up with all of the things that were my parents' fault. It's something that I think is a common theme for many of us, is there's always something or someone that's been wronging us or is wronging us, so that I have something that I can point at or point to, or eventually later in my drinking career that I can hang my hat on to justify the need to go out and escape. And so there had to have been something wrong with my parents. And the bottom line is, it never occurred to me for far too many years that it's actually there was something wrong with me. And I think my first addiction was approval. And that probably saved my life, or at least I think it did, because it was more important to me to get accolades and approval from my parents growing up than anything else. And so I, you know, drinking and those pot smoking, you know, those bad people. Sorry, it's not what I believed later, but those people were bad, and my parents said that that's bad for you. So I desperately wanted their approval, because that's how I was able to feel good. And, you know, there was something missing from day one. And some folks can come to this disease, and I think some folks come right out of the gates with it. And I'm pretty sure I was the latter. And so I grew up not knowing what was wrong, but something was wrong. There was a hole, and so I started by filling it with your approval, absolute, insecure pleaser. And so that's the only way I could derive any sense of self-worth. And so I immediately out of the gate didn't know how to have relationships. To me, you were something that I could get that I thought I needed. And that's all I thought about, the relationships and how what I had. So later in life, it became more exploitative, because the relationships that I had were, you weren't a person, and I didn't give a rat's butt about whether I had a relationship with you. You were an asset, and you had a value. So either you knew somebody, or you had something that I wanted and valued, and so that was why I would continue to present myself as a person, you know, that I hoped you saw as interesting. I remember climbing the corporate ladder, and it's kind of sad, but I would walk into a corporate event, and I would look around, and you know, just shamelessly self-promoting, which corporate America rewards, but the so it seemed to work for a while. I would look in the room, and I'd figure out, well, where are the people that I report to, and where's their boss? And then I would accidentally be standing behind them in line. I would systematically work the room to, you know, to what I thought I needed out of those relationships, so that I could be perceived in a certain way. And then whether and how well that went was how well that evening was to me. I mean, it was that exploitative, and it's kind of sad. So I never really, through high school, I was kind of a brainiac. And a nerd, and I was pretty awkward, but, you know, did fairly well in sports and just sort of overachieving and all of that type of stuff. I'm a yes person and a joiner and all those crazy things. But my first real experience with drugs and alcohol were when I got to college, because college for me was, I could get away with, and at that point it seemed okay because of the stories that my dad told and that kind of thing, that at college it was okay to have, to kind of do that type of thing, certainly drinking. And so I had permission, or at least felt like I had permission to drink. And so I don't really, like, remember the first drink and the bubbles and the burning down my throat and making my toes curl. That wasn't really my experience. You know, I think we kind of all have sort of things that make us click, and I would assert that some of the IV medications that I received in the hospital made me feel that way. But fundamentally, alcohol is my problem. It has always been there. It is what just about killed me, and will kill me if I don't aggressively pursue this program. And I know that in my heart, and I know that's a fact. So drugs are part of my story, but they're part of my disease, but they're not the root cause. And I know that in my heart. 100 proof vodka straight from the trunk on a Saturday afternoon in August. You know, just warmed perfectly, just like sake. Just, woohoo! right after breakfast. Yeah. I feel eminently qualified, unfortunately. But so I am. So drinking for me did allow me to be a lot less awkward. And a lot of, at least when I came in here, my family and everybody else around me, including my boss and others, told me that alcohol was my problem. And it's taken me a while, and I heard a speaker say this once, and I just, like, he has that backwards. He said, "And alcohol is my solution." I'm like, well, he got that mixed up. But then he went on to say that it worked for me for a very long time. And what it did is, you know, it was really my first relationship that I had, because alcohol was something that filled that hole. And so I was taller, and I danced better, and all the, you know, I told better jokes, and all of those things. And I periodically go out with people that drink, and I know none of that's true, because they're not taller and they suck at dancing. It's just that they think it's a disease of perception. And so there's nothing worse. I think it's really good teaching for me to go and hang out with people that drink because we're just so obnoxious. it's awful. If you're sober and you're with people that are half in the bag, it's not really fun. So, not at all. But so I did I was still on the achievement trail, but in college I learned immediately how to become a functional alcoholic. And that basically meant that I knew what I had to do and what I thought I needed to do, which was I was going to be a career guy and I was going to go, you know, capture the world and all that crap. And so I was going to go to business school. And so I was a straight-A student in college and got scholarships to go to business school and all those things. But I had a companion, and it was alcohol. And I had a couple of occasions where I almost died of alcohol poisoning. And I was drinking again within a week. I had no idea. I drank so much that if there was not an EMT that I, as my roommate, I don't think I would have lived through it. And, you know, and then the dread afterwards, the I'll never drink again, that anxiety and the knot in my stomach, and within 3 days, well, just a little. It's not going to be a problem. And in college, it's a great place to drink because you can hide as an alcoholic for a very long time in college, and I did that in college and in business school because I literally started a fraternity chapter in business school. So because there weren't, you know, the grad students were serious, and I needed an access. So it was all undergrads starting the fraternity. So I had my little party path, and so I could act and drink excessively and get away with it. And so all through college and business school and later in life, I formed a relationship with alcohol where I would basically do what I had to do and then drink, usually at night. So I would go to the cafeteria, I would go to the library for 3 or 4 hours straight, and when I got my work done, my reward was I could go out and drink. And I'd fill a bottle up with Bacardi 151. It was a large campus. And I would drink myself to blackout, and I'd wake up God knows where. And that's what I wanted. And it was fun. It was a party. I was a party boy. So, God, some of the places I woke up. So, shifting gears, I did well in school and graduate school because that pattern worked for me. Alcohol worked for me for a long time. It was my solution. It helped fill a void that nothing else could. And so I was a functional alcoholic for almost 30 years. And so it was really hard for me to accept that that was my problem when the time came. And so during the early part of my career, I got married and had two daughters, and then it was career, and I became a workaholic, and again, an approvalaholic. But there would be probably every 4 to 6 weeks on a weekend, I would have a blowout, and it'd be the same old deal. No, I'll never drink again. And then a couple weeks later, off we go. But so kind of fast forward, so that's kind of what it was like until the tail end. And for most of us, it's the what happened part is, at least for me, it's when it stopped working, when my longtime companion became my enemy. And it really basically netted out to it wasn't working anymore. I couldn't, I had to drink more to get where I thought I needed to be. And it became less predictable. For the longest time, I could have 2 or 3 drinks every night and more on the weekends and maybe occasionally be hungover the next day on the weekends and kind of go wake up where I thought I belonged in my bed and ready to work the next day. But after a while, that wasn't the case. I needed more to kind of get to escape. It was always to drink for relief, that sense of goodwill for the longest time, and I'm kind of a runner and a geography changer, I went everywhere. I mean, even in high school, I'm like, exchange student, sign me up. So, you know, South America, maybe I'll feel better over there. And, you know, before I went to business school, Alaska, well, I'll spend a summer up there. And I'm out in the Aleutian Chain, and I'm walking as far as I possibly can from the dock. And there's no power lines, as far away from civilization as you can get. And I couldn't find it because I brought it with me. And I didn't, so I just, as a complete runner, searcher, you know, all these crazy, jumping out of airplanes and cliff diving and anything that I could do to try and find this feeling that I just didn't have. I didn't know how to fix it. I didn't know what my problem was. Didn't really have any alcoholism in my family. They were all normies. And so I didn't have a clue. An alcoholic to me was somebody that didn't have a job, that couldn't support themselves, and that they were, you know, the classic, under a bridge, you know, track marks in their vein, whatever it was, that was the profile. And so for a very long time, especially at the tail end, I would hold that out as the reason why I wasn't one. And I've learned that if you call Helen, central office, she's been there, and she probably still will be for a long time. She's been there at least 30 years. Helen will tell you, if you think you're having trouble with drinking, Helen will tell you that doesn't matter the way you drank, the way that you mix things up. You could be an alcoholic by just drinking wine, or you could be the daily, hourly kind of drinker that I became. And so I'm going to switch away from my war story very quickly, because that doesn't matter. It's how it made me feel. The alcoholic, in the doctor's opinion, drinks primarily, or I don't know exactly the quote, but drinks fundamentally for the effect. And that's what I drank for, was that feeling of relief. And so if that's what alcohol does for me, then I may have a problem. And the rest of the pieces, excuse me, I'm 52 in the big book, it talks about, well, had problems with relationships. Check. Having trouble at work. Ooh, yep, check. You know, you just kind of go down the list, and it's haunting about how clearly you can diagnose this disease when it's time. And in the same sentence, how clearly we are the last person to admit it. And so towards the tail end, I also I have some medical conditions, and so I added drugs to the mix, and you know, prescription drugs in particular. And so I was heavily into opiates, and I could convince a doctor of anything, to the point where I looked up cluster migraines, because I was taking opiates, but then I wanted to take more, and I was getting these bad headaches in the morning, which is part of the mix, you know, alcohol, marijuana, opiates. You wake up with a headache, well, I better go see a doctor, something's wrong with me. And of course, what I wanted from the doctor was more opiates. And so he gave them to me. And so I could just convince doctors and was quite successful at feeding my addiction. And to me, it was an accelerator. That's all it was. And it just increased the unpredictability of this disease for me. So the outcome was getting worse and worse. And I quite frankly, I'm grateful. I can't. Today, I am so grateful that it sped it up. Because one, and I've gone through the steps several times, but so I don't have regrets so much. But if there's sort of one nagging thing, is that I wished I'd gotten sober sooner, because the life that I have today is so much better. And so that's kind of a wistful thing to have to deal with. But you know, it's not my call. I also know that I'm where I am. I'm exactly when I'm supposed to be, and that's that. But I didn't come to this disease very readily. We come here on circumstances, not on virtue. And I was definitely that. I didn't believe I had a problem. I knew I drank a lot, but I could quit anytime I wanted to. I just didn't want to yet. That's what I remember, swearing up and down and yelling at my wife if that was the case. And when it finally caught up with me and I realized, oh, shit. Oh, shoot, sorry. I think I have a drinking problem. I better stop. I couldn't. I thought I could, and that was terrifying. And then when it stopped working, then it really is living hell. There's no, I think all of us or any of us that have been there, there's no other description. For a low bottom alcoholic, it is just horrid. And losing my wife and family, they basically said, get better or else. And I remember promising with all my heart, with tears in my eyes, and meaning it, absolutely believing it, with complete conviction, I won't drink anymore. I promise, because I was destroying my life. I knew it. And I was drinking within hours. And, you know, the big book talks about pounding your fist on the bar. How did this happen again? And that's the confounding part of this disease, especially if you don't believe you have it. And the disease is designed to convince you that you don't. And I was definitely a candidate for that. And so going down in a great big ball of flames. So my first iteration was my wife walking out and my boss telling me I had a problem. And at the time, I was in a highly responsible position. And I was blacking out on conference calls. I mean, it's running an $80 million division. I'm just like, you know what? Just get on here asking your directors the next day, what did I say? You know, that's not a good way to run an organization. And I don't know, maybe you guys did, but it didn't work for me for very long. So it took my boss and my wife to say I had a problem. And the first time I came in to rehab was to hide. I'm like, all right, okay, I got a problem, you're right. But basically, I was escaping again. And that's what I did, is I came in to Ridgeview, great insurance and all those things. And I played softball for a summer and I got, you know, could quote the big book and go through the steps. And yeah, I got this, it's all good. And had a wonderful summer, had a good time. And we won quite a few games that year, softball team. but I didn't. I was still terminally unique. I was doing it my way. And I don't think I realized it until, as also is common, about 5 months, quote unquote, sober. And you know, I was without alcohol and drugs, and I was without a solution. And that's when I was picking up white chips, and I'd started back up. And, you know, I was lying. And that's even worse, because once you've got a little bit of recovery and you're going to meetings, and you're doomed, because it's just too much of a contradiction. And so I completely imploded. I had a mental breakdown. And remember, I've told this part about my story, but I was going to go to Utah. I had somebody out there that was going to hire me, and I just, the hell with my family, the hell with this, my job, I'm just out of here. And I made it almost to Buckhead. quite a ways, really. And I remember just, I just lost it. I called my wife bawling, and I didn't tell them that I'd left, and I'd broken into her office, you know, her corporate office, because I knew that she'd taken some of my medications down there. I mean, it was out of my freaking mind. And that's what happens when, at least for me, without this solution and without my other solution, I was a dead man. I was completely nuts. And so I told my wife I'd meet her at Ridgeview, and in the parking lot, I took every single pill that I had and overdosed, and I cut my wrists, and I thank God I was right next to the hospital. And so I went in on suicide watch, and that's glamorous. You know, it's just like, okay, well, you know, it's working for me. You know, my thinking has gotten me here. It's not what we think should happen. And I remember, you know, wake up from several days later, and I'm sitting on a mattress with nothing, because, you know, they take everything away. It's just sort of like burlap bag thing, and there's this big black guy in a metal chair, because their job is to sit and watch you so you don't hurt yourself. So I look up and, hi.
Hi.
You know, that's just, it's awful. And so... So I went into a long-term recovery program, and again, I fought it. I was going to do it my way one more time, and thank God I found a sponsor who knew me cold. And he called me out, and I finally, you know, you're in recovery, you're supposed to write your story and tell your roommates and all that kind of stuff. And yet again, I'm just stupid. I'm like, well, some of these guys have like prison records and they were drug dealers and they're really glamorous stories to me. And I'm like, well, I want to have the best story. So I made one up. Just like, what the hell? I want to kind of be a badass, so I'm going to make up a better story. It's ridiculous. And you know, so I had made the mistake of telling my sponsor a little bit of my background, and you know, he heard about this, and he's like, really, Carl? What? Like prison and, you know, working in a corporation, those mix. I was in prison for a while. Still, yes, so it didn't. I finally just caved. You know, he asked me, how is this working for you? Do you like your life? And I didn't. I didn't like who I was, and it was just time to stop. So I surrendered. It was a huge relief. And I listened to my sponsor, and I hate that rat bastard, and I love him. Because he knew me. He knew me, and he knew me. And so I couldn't get away with anything. For the first time in my life, I'd surrendered, and I've committed to listen, because I knew I was dead if I did not figure this out. I finally accepted that this, and for a while, death was okay. But I didn't want to die. I was too much of a chicken shit to do that. I was too scared to kill myself, and didn't want to go back out drinking. I just didn't want to go down that way. And so I figured, why not? Well, I'll try it. I'll try it your way. And so I did. But he forced me to go through the steps. He made me go through willingness. I was on step one for 4 months because I was not willing. I was not ready. And thank God he held me to it. But then it clicked. I finally accepted. I was willing to go to any length to get the solution. And I remember... it just started to help out. I'd always kind of been, I had the church upbringing and that kind of stuff, but I used to ridicule religion. And it took me a while to separate God, religion, and spirituality. But I'd always hunted and fished growing up in New England, and I loved that. It was something that truly was a joy to me. And so I was able finally to have permission in this program about picking your own higher power, where I could connect the two. And so it allowed me a path to find a spiritual connection. And truly, that is the most powerful thing in the world. It has to be for me. Writing the job description for my higher power. You know, my sponsor. Basically the same thing. It's like write the description for your higher power. Few criteria. They have to be bigger than you. And so I did, and you know, I spent hours trying to come up with the right writing, and he didn't even freaking look at it. He said, I don't care, as long as you've got one. No, and then he took me out in the park, and at that point, I still, you know, out of all of my horrid behavior, I mean, there's lots of rotten stories about my behavior, but, you know, so I'm like self-conscious now. We're out in the park because we're going to pray. And I don't want to get any, someone might see me. Might be seen on my knees praying. Oh my gosh, how embarrassing. I'm like peeing out in public in a bar on the table. That's okay. But this, oh no, don't get caught on my hands and knees saying a prayer. But the third step prayer, staring with Holden, you know, also just learning to have relationships with people. It was with men, and it was very different for me. And so... actually holding his hand, looking him in the eye, and going through and saying the third step prayer together is still probably the most moving experience I've ever had. I'll never forget it. I mean, if I start to cry, it would be now. Because it was the point where I finally knew it was going to be okay. that I actually could live and find a path in life. And so, my fourth step, again, Laser Eye sponsor, was pretty critical of my fourth step. He'd write it up, and of course I wrote it up. He said, okay, now write the truth.
Oh. But this is so much better.
He just had me cold. And so the fourth and fifth step, I didn't really, I didn't get that massive lift right away that some people talk about, but a month later I did. Because putting it in writing, it was kind of odd, the things that the stories and the things that I was holding out in life to justify why I deserved to drink and why I needed an escape. All those things, those little snippets in our life that we carry around in our head that we just play back over and over again, or at least I do, and it reminds me, this is why I need to drink. And just looking at them on paper, I wasn't as good of a person as I thought I was, and I wasn't as bad of a person. And as my sponsor is supposed to do, he pointed out patterns to me. And six and seven went. I work a lot more on those now, but in early sobriety, you know, we kind of went through them. But at that time, I wasn't really ready for the depth of that process, the true understanding of humility, and that will be a long road. I hope I never figured those out. Then the amends process. And again, I didn't have a huge list of amends. My sponsor was of the mindset that amends is really of the school of thought that it's not everyone that you might have wronged in life or any girlfriend that you might have spurned or anything like that. The amends process was the result of an inventory. It used to be fundamentally that people had bar tabs that they'd run up and that type of thing, and the idea is to just settle your accounts. And it's going to be a valid harm that you can repair. When people, it's interesting, because I when I first was in rehab the first time around, I went from, I have a problem, I'm going to get better, to going to all the people that I thought I heard, I'm sorry. That was my amends process. And that worked really well. Because I'd never said I'm sorry to them before. And I'd never said, oh, I promise this time it will be different. Like they were going to believe that. I think the most moving amends that I had was with my uncle that had passed away. He was terminal cancer when I was at the peak of my little circus. And he was really close to our family. He lived with us for a while, and every Sunday dinner, holidays, we were really, he was kind of my second dad. And he was dying, and all I cared about was the drugs that he had in his cabinet. And I made sure that I was the first person that my aunt called so that I could go over there. And the first thing I did when she was upstairs was I said, well, I'll throw all this stuff out. And I put it in the trunk of my car, and I felt like it was Christmas. Mm-hmm. And that's just disgusting. And so that's a painful part of my story. And so in my amends, he passed away, obviously. And so I started visiting his gravesite, and I wrote a letter, and then I remember looking down at. To me, I feel like we get a lot of encouragement. If I actually slow down and open my eyes, I can tell when I'm in my higher power's will versus my own, because there's less chaos, and also that there's some type of kind of talk about God shots or these coincidences or whatever. To me, they're just. I'm not even surprised by him anymore. We start to rely on it. It's true. It just happens. It's like, oh yeah, of course, you know, oh thanks. You know, to me, it's like there's a breadcrumb or something that says I'm on the right trail. And I remember just glancing down, because I had no idea when he died. I didn't know anything. I looked down at the date, and it was my sobriety date. And it's like, creepy, back of my head. But it was thank God. And I was in long-term recovery. I needed, I basically, it took me over a year in halfway houses and three-quarter houses and everything else to recover. But today, so what's it like today? It's a lot better. I've gone through a divorce. I've gone through in sobriety. And, you know, at the time it looked like I was going to lose my daughters. It was an ugly divorce. But I did it what I thought with my sponsor, and we closely went through this, and I just did it in the accord to this program, which is counterintuitive to what your lawyer says to do, by the way, just in case. And quite frankly, I was getting my ass kicked, right? Because if you're honest and all that sort of stuff, it's ugly. And so I was down to, like, maybe visitation, supervised visitation, you know, because I'd had enough wreckage in the past that it was pretty easy for that to be the case. I remember praying for clarity and for the opportunity to be a better father. And I've learned about prayer. Be very careful. Be very careful. Because they come true. And through a combination of circumstances, my wife had had enough of my daughters, and she dropped them off with their things and said, "They're not welcome in my house anymore," just before the ruling was going to come down. And so suddenly, I was thinking maybe, you know, every other weekend or something, but whoa! I didn't really want that! And so I have full custody of my daughters. And that's a living amends. That is truly, you know, when I think about service work, I see it every day. I wake up and it's like, so I'm in a season of life. I need to, you know, I'm kind of a sponsor. I raise these kids now. I've remarried, and she has three kids as well. So, you know, and she has sole custody. So we got five of them. And we're insane. But it's a huge responsibility, and it is a massive blessing. Because it's an opportunity for me to be a decent father. And it's an amends. And so for me, this is what I think of as part of service work. When you look at what it says, is to be of service. The seven-step prayer is to take away my difficulties. Not for me, so that my dog comes back and I get my job back and my life is better. That's not what it's for. It's so that I can be of service to you and to others. And so that can take many forms. It can be normies. I married a normie. And not only that, but she's brutally honest. And thank God. So I get crisp reminders every single day. And so it's built in humility. That's awesome. And it's annoying, but it's perfect. Because I need that. That's been a blessing. It's been an opportunity. I have had the opportunity to pursue my career, but I don't confuse the difference between my life working well today and this program. They're not, you know, for a long time I thought that one meant that something good had to happen, and that's what was supposed to happen. That is not the case. Life dishes out the same crap it always has. And the difference is perspective. This is a disease of perspective. So I could look at my current job and my current boss and my current wife and my current kids and say, you know what, I need to drink because they do this and he does that and they do this and because of that. Or because of this program, I can just be grateful as hell that I have it, that I have an opportunity to live and that I was a dead person. Literally and figuratively and spiritually. And so I live now, and I'm grateful for it, and it's changed my perspective. So I just in a couple minutes, I think something I like to kind of reflect on is I need to live this program every day. And when I was drinking and using excessively, my morning would start with, usually I'd wake up with the sweats and a migraine headache and in total fear. And my first thoughts were, do I have enough for today? Do I have enough whatever? Drugs, alcohol, the things that I needed, or how am I going to make sure I have enough so that I could stay using and drinking? You know, stop by and get more vodka. Check. Step one. Call somebody to get some other things. Check. You know, call a doctor and get another prescription. Check. You know, that was my day. And it was basically focused on getting what I needed so I could just get through my day. And it was horrible. But I think now I have two possible days that can start for me. The first one is the one without this program, and I wake up and it's the, you know, it's the peanut gallery. I'm still nuts, and I still desperately need this program. I wake up and it's just like, you're fat, you suck, you ate too much last night, you know, and that's how it starts. You know, it's like the little ticker underneath. It's, you know, the crap that you did the day before. All of that stuff just starts rolling. And, you know, and my day immediately takes a sharp left-hand turn. And, you know, and I'm still fat. And then it plays over again and over again. And I'm just sitting there. And then the circus music starts up. And it's just, it's awful. I mean, that's literally what is in store for me every single morning if I don't have this program. And my sponsor's helping me with this. He's like, well, this, and kind of he really appreciates this perspective. And he's like, well, if you wake up and start thinking about your higher power and your connection, try and connect sooner and sooner so that it is absolutely the very first thing. Don't even give yourself a minute. 2 minutes, 5 minutes, and I'm really screwed. My day is completely south. But give yourself a few minutes, or and you're in trouble, but don't give yourself that time and just get it done. And so the third way, and the way that it's described in the big book, is we wake up in the morning and we start with our, you know, we start with our prayers. And that's how I do that. As soon as I possibly can, I connect and I roll down on the floor and I hit my knees. I don't know why it matters, but it matters to me. To this alcoholic, I need to be on my knees. And I start with the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, and then the St. Francis prayer. And you know what? Then my day is a lot different. We consider our plans. We pause when agitated. You know, you hear these things, it's like, you're right, I don't always do that. I wished I did. But it's there. The path of right living is in this program. This big book is the solution, not a solution, the solution that will help me recover from a deadly disease. I've buried too many friends. And I'm sure many of you in this room have as well. And so this is a way for me. It provides me a way with living now that's different. It's not, you know, I'm still here. The circus is always in town, and it's there at a split second away. But this program is here, and if I follow it, and if I don't chase after, directly after things, but just focus on how do I have a better relationship with my higher power? How do I work with others? How do I participate in this program? Go to meetings, talk to my sponsor, help other men in sobriety, be of service. I go through the steps. I'm on step 8 with my sponsor. I'll always be going through the steps. And I go through them with sponsees when I've got them active and they don't run off or heal themselves or whatever. But I have a perfect track record with sponsees because I'm sober today. And that's what sponsoring, at least was taught to me, is what that's for. Because I can't put my life, like at the beginning of my story, I can't place my self-worth in somebody else's hands. It is absolutely an inside job. And so today, what it's like is it's a wonderful experience. I'm grateful to this program. I'm allowed to do things now that I can't believe where I am. I've just sort of picked up my toes and just went drifting down the river and said, just whatever you want me to do. And I find myself in the oddest situations. I'm like, when I first came out into recovery, what I thought I needed and what I thought I would have liked isn't even close. And so I have, I'm doing things and I'm in a life that I never, ever would have imagined. And I love it. I really do. So that's my story. Wow.